I'd like to call us to order. Thank you for joining us again. Thanks, members, for coming here, and the public for watching. And we're continuing our walk through the different math studies of the various departments. And today we're doing sex offenders and chemical and mental health services, which should be quite interesting. I have a shadow today. This is Hunter Burns, who's sitting up here by me. I thought if you're in a shadow, you should actually then have to be in the shadow. So he's up here, and there's 25 people from your school. And just pull the mic over there and tell us what school you're from. And okay. Hello, Hunter. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I am Hunter Burns from RTR. That's Russell Tyler Ruthin, and I'm here with the Minnesota SDCLA, and we are the Family, Career, and Community Leaders of America, and we are a student-run organization that focuses on family roles and different things that happen in the community.
Thanks, and you have a project. Want to hold up your little poster there, and people can see that? And sit down and tell us what that is, will you?
It is a pledge to not to text and drive, and that works with our FACTS program, Families Acting for Community Traffic Safety.
Yeah. So anyway, thanks for bringing that. Yeah, so welcome, Hunter, for being here, and to your peers. And this is the future of America here, so I think we're in pretty good shape. We have there's a couple things in your packets. There's a bunch of literature from your for the presentations. We have a list that probably is final about these study groups, and if you're interested, lobbyist group, you'll want to have these, and we'll have extra copies of these maybe laying around there. Yeah, and so Andy, let's put the rest of these at the corner so people can come just grab one if they didn't get one. I appreciate the level of involvement of I think all the members are doing something pretty much. These are study groups. They're not work groups. They're not public forums. They're legislators working on their own in a group to learn about these different topics, but also to know how to best preserve the essential and important elements and manage them within the targets we'll have to do. And I hope they're productive, and I appreciate the intent that people had as they signed up. In bold, you'll see the different leads on those study groups, and you'll also see what staff is going to be supporting those efforts. Not all the members are here yet, but we don't have a lot of time. We've now burned through 2 weeks of session. How about that? And our deadline will be in March sometime, I suppose. They haven't told us that, and those are under discussion. But you know, to have a viable set of proposals, you have to actually have some time to work on them. And so, you know, you'll want to get together soon and start learning things. And between Christine and Holly, they can get you hooked up with departmental staff. Some of the different groups that are around here with different interest groups can support you in some knowledge stuff. So if you're going to come up with some solid ideas, probably 3 or 4 weeks we're going to have to start producing some things, and that's that. Just another, probably an editorial comment here. There's two more pieces of paper. There's an article from Lori Sturdivant, and then this single piece says Anoka Legislative Delegation. This came from my superintendent, and we have abridged his presentation to be only one plate, but this was part of his summary comments. And I was just interested, as we were talking about education, that that they recognize in our relatively lean Anoka Hennepin School District about how to stretch the money. And he says, we'll do more with less. We'll have to prioritize programs and services. What we decide to do, we must do very well. We must be well positioned to compete for resources and students. We'll continue to be flexible and ready to change. We'll continue to make the decisions we must. And it's a very pragmatic, I think, thoughtful thing. I didn't write it, but I thought this is kind of cool. Just as we judge our work going forward. And it won't be easy, but this is not a bad set of principles. And then Lori wrote a nice editorial about the governor, asking if he would be transactional or transformational. And I hadn't thought of that. And I still have yet to meet the governor, and I don't know if he'll be transactional or transformational. But I think this committee has a chance to be transformational if we will be so. Past efforts at balancing budgets, I think, have simply been transactional sometimes just because of all kinds of reasons. But I think if we apply ourselves, and these groups maybe are a part of the effort of that, that we could truly be transformational. And that's my thought there. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read that also this weekend, and I'm just wondering if committee members feel clear about the differences. I mean, when I came to the legislature, I heard a lot about transactional work, transactional power. It wasn't a term necessarily used in the private sector where I'd worked before, or in the union world where I'd worked before. So I'm just wondering if you had 2 cents to offer on that before we move on.
Go ahead. You want to offer it?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I'm still learning, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And by the way, I just it's funny how you get in the... Sometimes I made the mistake of reading comments on some of the news stories. And you and I were in a news story last week talking about our hearing. And people loved us and hated us, both. So I felt kind of special. And so different people had different opinions that they were expressing.
But Mr. Chair, doesn't that become sort of the normal feeling around here,
yeah,
to be loved and hated?
So it was pretty equal. That didn't take a vote on the comments. But I think, tomorrow we're going to do a bill, which is simply a transactional one. We're going to... it's introduced. It's maybe I gave it here to Tom and to the. It's continuing some budgeting things that have been done in the past. That's transactional. There's nothing transformational about that. That's just. But the work we can do in these study groups, the work we have to do to preserve the really good things that we're doing, if we can focus on that, that will be transformational to the system. And so, if we can think about 2 years, 4 years, 10 years from now, as we make our decisions, and the more I have these meetings with people, the more I'm just frightened about just the delicacy of that work, which is why we have these study groups, and so people can be more informed. So hopefully that'll be a positively transformational opportunity. So, and talking with I had a chance to talk with Dr. Ellinger on the health department, and it seems like he's very interested in that. I still have to connect with the new commissioner, human services, but everybody expresses an interest in doing what we all would express interest in doing, and that's finding solutions, and I'm going to keep helping us go there. So anyway, and the minutes are in front of you. Representative Schumacher would like to move the minutes, and any discussion about that? Thanks for doing that. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? They're adopted. And so now I think we can move to our presentations, right? So if the department wants to come down, we'll talk about sex offenders. And we've got, the short half hour for you about that. What is that? Okay, that's in your... Okay, we have a reading test today. This chart here is, I guess, what they'll be working off of. Welcome to the committee and... Oh, the department. Oh, this is the department. Hang on a second. Oh, there it is. This is a department org chart. Sorry. Anyway, so Hunter, you can take this back and help them understand how the department works. And what materials are you working off of, Mr. Benson? Do you have materials that you're working off of? Oh, that was a PowerPoint. Okay. There's just a lot of papers today. Hunter, one thing you get over really early in the legislative process is worrying about if you're wasting paper or not, because it's all about knowledge. So anyway, speaking of knowledge, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dennis Benson. I'm the executive director of MSOP, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. With me today is Janine Hebert, the executive clinical director, and Dan Storkamp. We're going to give you a very short overview of the program and some budget issues that I think you'll find relevant to our discussion as we move through session. I think everybody knows that this is a program that is driven by statute, and we are compelled to provide treatment for those found to be sexually dangerous or sexual psychopaths. That sets this program apart from similar programs in the Department of Corrections, and certainly there are some parallels between this kind of civil commitment and those that might be civilly committed as MI or MIND. But this is a program comprised of primarily sex offenders. Some quick facts here. Today we have a total of 656 individuals who are civilly committed. 51 of those are dually committed in the state prison system, but when they complete their prison sentence, they will come to one of our two facilities. We have two facilities, one at St. Peter and one at the Moose Lake facility. We have about 722 full-time equivalents, and our budget this year is $67.4 million. Again, we have beds up at the Moose Lake facility. We have approximately 400 at that facility and a couple hundred down at St. Peter. Moose Lake is the front end of treatment. That's where admissions occur, and primary treatment. The end stages of treatment occur down at the St. Peter facility.
Mr. Chair, I'm Janine Aber. I'm the Executive Clinical Director of MSOP. I'm going to do the next couple of slides. This slide is an overview of the civil commitment process for sexually dangerous persons and sexual psychopathic personalities, which are the two commits that MSOP serves. The Department of Corrections reviews cases before an individual's time is up to make determination whether that case is referred back to the county for consideration for commitment. If the county pursues that case and the individual meets criteria for SDP or SPP, they are initially committed. 60 days later, that case is again reviewed to see if that person still meets criteria, and then they are finally committed. And to the best of our knowledge, we're the only civil commitment program in the country that has this two-step process. Once someone's finally committed and they are residing at MSOP, they have the option to petition for a decrease in custody, provisional discharge, or full discharge every 6 months. And in the case of SDP-SPP, those petitions are considered by the Special Review Board, which is a three-person panel determined by the Commissioner of DHS. They make a recommendation to the Supreme Court of Appeals panel, which is a three-judge panel. And it's that body that makes determinations for placement outside of the fence or provisional discharge or full discharge. So when we talk about courts in and courts out, that's what we mean, that the county courts determine who comes to MSOP, and it's the Supreme Court of Appeals panel who determines who leaves MSOP.
Just a question. Ms. Hebert, on the referral part, on the way in, mm-hmm. and you have a two-part thing, and are some of the ones that might have been referred then diverted to something else because they realize it's not a productive, it's not the right setting for that particular individual, and how many are diverted?
Mr. Chair and members, this slide here is a snapshot of the history of referrals. And when the case is referred to the county can choose to pursue it or not, and then if they pursue it, it may or may not end up in a commitment. And of the cases that are referred to the counties, about 50% for the SDP-SPP cases result in commitment. So in this slide here, you'll see the referrals that Department of Corrections made in the past few years to the counties, with the obvious blip of 2003, which was the Drew Shedin tragedy, when the referrals went up significantly. Since then, we've seen a decrease in that, and we think it's plateaued out. So we're growing between 50 and 60 a year. You'll see that on our projections. So you'll see that in 2009, we had 114 referrals. Now, of course, it takes a while for the county to prosecute that and to choose if that meets criteria or not. But we're looking at about 50% of those that do go to the county.
And for the freshmen in particular, this is always a touchy hearing to have. So, and so because there's a lot of sensitivities around it, but these individuals in the program are in treatment. They're not prisoners. They're working toward a goal of, rehabilitation and moving on to the next step. And so maybe Mr. Benz, you just want to maybe just to get that covered early just so people can understand that part.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, that's absolutely correct. And again, as I mentioned earlier, that's what sets this program apart from treatment of sex offenders in prison. We are compelled to offer treatment to everybody in the program. Now, they also have the right to refuse treatment, which that number continues to increase. We're up to about 80 to 85% involvement in treatment. That's up from about 50%. With respect to the question, though, that you asked regarding what happens to the people that don't make it into the program, some of those people might end up in a community-based treatment program, but most of those people simply go out or leave prison and are on supervision. And that, I think, is one of the weaknesses in the Minnesota civil commitment continuum. You are either in or you're out. There's no real middle ground. And I think that is becoming an issue with many courts around the state, in that we're sensing that there's some reluctance to commit people because the number of people, obviously, that have been released is next to none. So people are, I think we've got to be careful moving forward about the public safety issue of not having some middle ground for some of these folks who don't quite meet the criteria for civil commitment, but certainly are probably not the best prospects for a successful reintegration without additional treatment upon leaving prison.
Thank you. And Representative Franson, do you have a question? Hold the mic down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Benson, as a daycare provider, I get notices when an offender has moved into the area to alert myself and the families of those I serve. What is the successful reintegration percentage-wise? I mean, how many of these people go through your program or go through the program and come out cured?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have not had anybody move through the program and successfully be reintegrated into the community yet. As we sit here today, we have two individuals that are being considered by the Supreme Court Appeal Panel, as Ms. Hebert mentioned earlier. Those hearings will occur in the next 6 months. We have to understand that there are two groups of sex offenders: the civilly committed sex offenders, that's our program, and again, we have not had anybody released successfully. We've had one go out several years ago, was out a few months, came back in. I think the group that you're referring to are those that are leaving prison, and they go through the community community notification process, level 3 sex offenders, and the community becomes aware that they're moving into the neighborhood. So those questions around recidivism of sex offenders really need to be directed at the Department of Corrections. And I can tell you that having spent 34 years in corrections, those numbers vary dramatically depending on the kind of sex offenders we're talking about. But certainly there are some sex offenders as a group anyway, that experience a very low recidivism rate. With respect to the issue of can we cure them, my clinical staff tell me daily that we don't use that word. What we think we can do is reduce that risk to a point in some cases where we can successfully manage them in the community, and that's really what we strive for in our program. Once you're a sex offender, you're probably always going to be a sex offender, and we're going to have lots of services wrapped around that individual, particularly the people that make it into our program. Out of the 18,000-plus registered sex offenders in the state of Minnesota, remember now, the funnel gets narrower and narrower and narrower, and we're down to the 650 that end up in our program. So they're a challenging group. Many of them don't want to get out. Some of them don't participate in treatment. Some of them will never successfully complete treatment, and they will remain with us for a long time. And that is also a cost driver. We have a population that is continuing to age. The health care costs are exorbitant. We have a unit of folks who are barely ambulatory, can care for themselves. I was made aware of a case today of a guy who was in his upper 80s, came in November, has several health care issues, including heart, prostate cancer, anemia, macular degeneration, on and on and on, and now we're going to care for him. So it there are lots of cost drivers for this program. And the other issue, of course, is what are the alternatives? So we are happy to engage today and through session on some thoughts and ideas about how we might continue to work with this population and manage the cost, manage the growth, and not compromise public safety.
Well, thanks, and I think we'll let you do your presentation. But actually, before you go, would you tell us who your shadow is there, Representative Franson?
this is my youngest son, Colin. He turns 4 next week, and he knows that in the committee you just sit there and color and listen. So he did very well in egg. We'll see how he does in this fun setting.
You know, just getting to sit and color sounds pretty good.
It's very therapeutic, Chair.
Continue. Who's ever going to go next?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and members. And in the spirit of that, here's our most colorful slide that we have to show. MSOP has 3 phases of treatment. I'm just going to give you a brief overview on this to provide some context for what Dan Storkamp's going to speak to next. There are 2 sites that Mr. Benson spoke about, up at Moose Lake and St. Peter. They have 2 very different missions. Up at Moose Lake, it is our reception facility. It also houses individuals who choose to not participate in treatment. And it houses individuals during the first 2 phases of treatment. So the majority of treatment and programming happens up at Moose Lake. St. Peter has 2 main missions. One is that it provides programming for our alternative clients, which are individuals with what is known as compromised executive functioning, which translates to perhaps developmental disabilities or traumatic brain injury or neurological issues that prevent them from being successful in the conventional program. So if someone who is an alternative client, they're processed up at Moose Lake, and then they do all of their programming down in St. Peter. The second mission at St. Peter is, of course, reintegration, and you'll see that in the steps. So the step on the far left is individuals come in the door up at Moose Lake. They do their primary treatment up at Moose Lake as well on the purple step. We do polygraphs and physiological assessments to support or not clients' self-report. They progress through treatment, and if they're successful, eventually are transferred down to St. Peter into what we call MSI, which is the Supervised Integration Program, and that begins their transition of reintegration. Once they get down to St. Peter, they have ankle bracelets put on them because they can progress through treatment to privileges, which include walking on campus escorted with staff in St. Peter, going in the community escorted with staff, and then eventually the third level is to be able to walk on campus unescorted, and all of that is supervised by ankle bracelet as well as covert surveillance. Those decisions of moving clients through the first 3 steps there are made programmatically, and that's up to us to make those decisions. Once a client is ready to be placed in the community preparation service, that's sort of that 4th step there, that kind of lime green color, that is determined by the SRB and by SCAP. So we can't place clients outside of the secured perimeter in the programming of CPS without the court approval. Then similarly, those individuals petition for the next step, which is again court-determined provisional discharge, and then court-determined full discharge. Since this slide has been made, I'm not certain if you can see the numbers on the very top, but we currently, as of today, have 7 clients in the community preparation services. This was updated as of January 1st when we had 6. So we recently added our 7th client, the courts did, and chose to place that person out in community preparation service.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Starkey. I'm the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I'll be covering the next slides that cover kind of population trends as well as some of our budget numbers that'll be real of interest, I'm sure, to this committee. The population chart that you see in front of you shows 2 components. The one on the left side of the chart is the actual population. And as Janine talked about, 2003 was a dramatic year for the program. Many more referrals went out, and as a result, you can see there was a steady increase in population from 2003 to the present. As of January 1st, we have 605 in the program. The right side of the chart shows our projections moving forward. That's based on current trends, current laws, and current practices. What we're showing is about 50 increase per year. And actually, the first 6 months, the projection, we're looking at by January 1, having 603, and we have 605. So as of today, we're right on projected populations. In 2007, we actually...
Before you move off, there was a note about the 50 clients and dual commitments. Are those in treatment as well in a correctional site, or what's going on with those?
Again, to participate in treatment, it's up to them to do so. So I would suspect that they're directed to do treatment on the Department of Corrections, and whether or not they choose to participate, it's up to them.
Mr. Chair, the next slide actually shows a couple components that Minnesota Sex Offender Program has changed over the last 3 years. We had a change in our program that actually increased the safety, public safety of the program, as well as the security of the facility, changed policies, and improved client participation in treatment, as Mr. Benson talked about, from 50% to 80%, as well as improved some continuous improvement processes were implemented. What this resulted in is actually a decrease in our staffing needs from almost a little over 900 to just over 700, so about 200, and at the same time increased almost 200 in population. This actually results in a significant change for the budget. On the next slide, you can see from 2007 to 2009, our base budget decreased by $10 million because of the changes that we implemented into the program. You'll see a slight increase in 2011, or fiscal year 11, and that is now going to show as trends and growth trends continue, is we're going to need additional dollars for those additional growth moving forward. On the next slide, the budget and the number of clients changing also changes our per diem. In 2007, the per diem was $387. In 2011, or fiscal year 11, moving forward here, it's $328. So every time that we can add a new person into our program, and you'll see that our marginal per diem of that is $144. So it just basically means for every new person, it's only $144 a day compared to the $328 overall. But more people coming in means that our per diem will actually go down over time. Now, we did a quick comparison to other states. Some civil commitment programs range from $100 to $500 per day, but there's really no consistent way of tracking those per diem numbers. Every state does it different. Everybody calculates it a little bit differently. What you'll see in this next chart is our per diem numbers. We actually have what we call a fully loaded per diem. Basically, this includes all costs not only directed to the program, the $67.4 million, but it's also the support cost. Indirect and bonding costs are also calculated in. As a result, our total per diem is $328 per day, and with an average population of 612 overall. As we move forward, the two issues that MSOP are going to be facing with is really the growth, and dealing with the growth is going to be two components for budget issues. One, increased funding for the additional staff for that growth, as well as the additional bed space needed for bonding issues. And I'm sure this legislature has dealt with that this last year.
I have a question, members. This is the end of your formal presentation.
Correct.
Is the 12-13 budget increment included in the forecast, or is that something we have to appropriate separately?
Mr. Chair and members, that forecast or growth number is not forecasted. It is a discussion that we will continue to have with the incoming administration. But as Mr. Storkamp indicated, our growth, our projected growth, is approximately 100 during the course of the next biennium. The other thing I would say is about 80%+ of our budget is staffing. And of that number, much of it is clinical staff, and of course we are compelled to provide treatment, so we have lots of clinical staff provide the constitutionally required treatment.
So just to clarify, so it's the increased funding in this instance is not part of the proposed deficit. We have to add actually to that to fund you guys, is that right?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. We do not have a growth component at this point.
And I realize now we have a governor, you can't tell me what you think you'd be asking for, because they will decide that. But so it's, I know, that's helpful. So the little surprises just keep coming, and we certainly want to buy your services, so I suspect you'll find a willing ear here, but this gets the little peak gets a little steeper all the time. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, Dr. Benson. You'd referenced before the a step down or a different level Do you have a proposal in that regard, or have you made a proposal before, that sort of thing? Because as far as financially is concerned, that might be one methodology that we could use to maybe enable us to not have to increase funding to such a high degree. So have you had a proposal before? Might you have one now that you might be able to offer to us?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, we have certainly had lots of internal discussion. We will continue to discuss some options around some thoughts and ideas that we have with the incoming administration. Our commissioner just started last week. We will be meeting with her this week, and we will continue to flesh out some of those thoughts and ideas about what could we do differently that might make some sense to manage this population a little bit more efficiently, or at least the growth of this population. There are a total of 20 programs around the country, and they all do them a little bit differently, but we've also done our due diligence with respect to what seems to work in some other jurisdictions and what could work here. But as we sit here today, we're not prepared to offer any options. We do understand the sense of urgency around this issue and also the need to balance controlling that growth with the public safety components. We have done some things in the past around sentencing policy, keeping some sex offenders in prison a little bit longer at that lower rate, as opposed to letting them out and letting the courts decide whether or not they meet the civil commitment criteria. There may be some things we can do around that, but I think there are also some things we can do around our program, around the referral process, the courts process. Remember now, every district court might have just a wee bit different spin on who meets the criteria and who doesn't. So you're dealing with all of these different jurisdictions. Centralizing that might be one thought or idea that we've talked about internally so that there's more continuity and consistency in how they get into the program. There are some other thoughts and ideas we have too. Again, the gentleman that I talked about, an 88-year-old man coming into a $328 a day program, probably isn't going to have enough life left to complete treatment if he were interested in pursuing treatment. So there are things like that I think we just got to look at and manage a little bit differently. But again, we need our mantra continues to be, and we're not playing conscious pilot here, but it's courts in, courts out. We are the provider of treatment. Whoever the court sends us, we have to deal with. So anything that we come up with, we really have to negotiate with the courts on both the front end and the back end.
Thanks. We're hitting the clock here, but there's four people with questions, and that's totally fine. So maybe you can have short answers, Mr. Benson and whoever. And a lot of these questions are better done in a offline, because some of the, just because it's just better to take it offline. So, but Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Benson, could you give us an update on the facility improvements and enhancements that we have authorized to this point, and what the status of that is? And then secondly, could you talk about the connection between the facilities that you have available, capacity to serve, and being able to take care of those who are civilly committed, and what happens if you're not able to take people in?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's a good question and a fair question. I can tell you that our construction that was bonded last year is on schedule. It's going well. We are pleased with where we're at. I would remind everyone, though, that $47 million only provides infrastructure program space. It does not add additional beds, and that's up at the Moose Lake facility. The total request of $89 million was almost cut in half, so we nixed the beds in favor of continuing to have the policy debate around our continued growth. We do have a plan in place to do some very light remodeling down at a couple of buildings at the St. Peter campus that would increase our capacity by about 50. That will probably limp us through till next year, and then we're going to have a bonding discussion again to add additional beds to continue to accommodate anticipated growth if we don't come up with policy decisions around managing growth.
Just a follow-up. What happens if your facilities can't accommodate those who might be civilly committed? What happens to those people then?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that would be an interesting test case. I can tell you that, again, these are civilly committed. They are not criminally committed. The option of cramming 2, 3, 4, 5 in a room, we don't have that kind of flexibility with this population as we did when I was the Deputy Commissioner in Corrections. Crowding was an option. It was never a good option. It certainly isn't a good option with this population. Remember who we're talking about here. My guess is we'd have problems with the court. This is a highly litigious population. We get sued just about every week on lumpy gravy or unmade beds or something. So I think we would work very hard with legislative leadership and the executive branch to make sure that we had room to accommodate growth. Now, we continue to look at other sites. There is a legislative report that we submitted this year that Mr. Storkamp was intimately involved in that lays out some ideas and suggestions about expansion. But I think we're compelled, if we have the law in place, I think we're compelled to find the space.
We're really hitting the clock on this. I have two more people, and Mr. Huntley wants to ask a question, too. But Representative Slawick, you have a short
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and two quick things. Yeah. One, I also have a shadow today. I just want to point her out, Jazzy, right, from near Marshall, Minnesota. So,
well, welcome.
Appreciate her being here today. And second of all, and Mr. Chair, I know as a new chair, it's hard to know how to pace the meetings. Yeah. This morning, I think in Maury Lanning's committee, we had 7 agenda items, and I think we got through 2 of them. So you've got 2 here, and you're doing really good, and we're not even halfway through the committee. So I appreciate you having probably took more time to say that than to ask my question. One thing that strikes me is you said that your biggest expense goes towards clinical staffing and towards staffing. You know, we're all kind of armchair quarterbacks here trying to figure out how to do this. We know your program better than we do, but are we, you're telling us that a program that has a zero recovery rate or people that are reformed, yet we have, that's our biggest cost is spending that time with people. Strikes me, wouldn't it be, could we cut down the amount of time we spend? Are we on par with other states? Could we cut down on the time if people aren't recovering?
Maybe you want to take some of that. That's a long answer, and it's a sensitive answer. I think that it's really important to recognize this is treatment, and that every person has a hope to get through this program successfully if they can be deemed to be recovered sufficiently to be safe to get in their communities. And just want to, Mr. Benson.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just very, very briefly and quickly. Remember, we're compelled by law to treat these folks. We are also licensed, and we have to meet licensing requirements that speaks to ratio of staff to clients is another issue. I'd also say that we are on the precipice, I believe, of breaking through, and there are 2 cases now that will go before the Supreme Court Appeal Panel, and I'm predicting that we're going to have our first provisional discharge in the next 12 months. This is not unusual nationwide that I think out of the, is it X number that are civilly committed, less than 10% have been released. Wisconsin has, I think, one of the most successful programs, and they're releasing 8 to 10 a year. We also understand that this has been a very politically sensitive environment in Minnesota, and I think that has started to subside a bit too, so that we need to continue to have a rational discussion around the management of sex offenders, and I do think that the wheels of this program are beginning to turn. I would say that in my opinion, as you saw earlier, we reduced the number of staff by a couple hundred. At the same time, the census went up by a couple hundred. I am not comfortable reducing any further either clinical or security staff at this point. I think we'd have trouble with the courts.
Thank you. And Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Benson, I was intrigued by your reference to this elderly patient that you have, and it made me think about the medical care costs. How are those paid? Doesn't this person get Medicare, or is that state dollars?
Mr. Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you're correct. That's kind of bounced around a little bit in the last year or two. It was Medicare, then we were talking about GAMC, and then they were going to go to MinCare, but now it looks like they'll probably go back to MA. And they cover a fair amount of it, but it's still tax dollars.
Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Benson, I think last year we had some discussion about the fact that a number of these people, certainly not a huge percentage, but are developmentally disabled as well as having the sexual predator problem. And there was some discussion last year about, since they're, some people would say they're less dangerous than some of the other people, and we were wondering whether there was a cheaper way to take care of that particular group that's in this facility, and is that legal?
Do you want to,
Mr. Chair,
take a short version of that and then take the rest of it offline, probably? That's a long answer, I think.
I'll make it short. About 20 to 25% of our population is lower functioning, 70 or less IQ. We do believe that there may be some other options in terms of how we might manage them. Again, I think under good supervision, they may be managed successfully in the community. This is a population that, were they not sex offenders, they'd probably be living in a group home of some sort, adult foster care. So I think it is another population or piece of our population that needs further study. We also, in the legislative report, talk about that a little bit and some thoughts and ideas we might have about moving them through the program a little bit differently than the more difficult, more sophisticated sex offenders.
And I think we're going to call it a day on the questions here. I just want to offer a comment about this. I, if you've gotten it, and thanks for coming, and you can, thanks for coming a lot. Some questions, some of the in-depth things you would want to ask about some programs are just so dicey to talk about as we look for ways to do it better and to improve this thing. Some of these comments are on the topic like redistricting comments on the floor, and they could come against you in as part of someone's testimony. And so that's why I'm just trying to keep this part short. But if you have ideas about how to, we could do some things differently, there is no working group or no study group on this topic. And so I'm kind of interested in it, and maybe some other members in the past have expressed interest in looking into ways about this. And I know Mr. Benson and his staff would avail themselves to whomever would like to spend some time talking about that in the privacy of their offices. And they will be back again to present whatever budget the governor's bill has for their committee as well. And and there's some more detail in the packet you have here. So with that, let's bring the next group up, the chemical folks. And and beyond that, to another comment, there is not enough time in the committee world to go into detail on every element of the human service budget. We would be here till June. You know, we did those one-day things with absenteeism committee. It's been an entire day on, like, this group. And still we had to move through the topics. And so that's why we have the study groups. That's why people have members stuff from last year. And so anyway, that's, I appreciate the committee and their advice about scheduling, too. So I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Anderson. And she's the lead on the study group, including Representative Barrett and Representative Liebling. And staff to support this will be Christine. So welcome to the committee. Actually, you can say welcome to the committee.
Welcome to the committee. Can you give us your name, please?
I'm Shirley Jacobson. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Chemical and Mental Health Services. And with me today is Gary Cox, who will be starting off the policy presentations for children's mental health. In your package, you should have a handout that is for chemical and mental health services.
This one for the committee. Okay. Go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. Slide number two starts out and gives you a presentation of what the Chemical and Mental Health Administration looks like. Chemical and Mental Health Administration is made up of the three policy divisions, one for children's mental health, one for adult mental health, and one for alcohol and drug abuse. And then the provider arm of the agency, state-operated services. I'm going to walk you through page three, which is basically the administrative and operations costs for the administration. And it is made up of two different orgs. It is the CMHS operations org, which includes the assistant commissioner's costs in his office. And the second line is a program psychiatric consultation, which was new in 2011. And it was part of the bill that was passed on the GAMC to offer psychiatric consultation to primary care physicians. I'm going to turn the presentation over to Mr. Cox to talk about the Children's Public Mental Health System.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gary Cox, and I'm a supervisor in the Children's Mental Health Division. Thank you very much for allowing us the opportunity to present some information on the public children's mental health system. The children that we serve in the public mental health system are a combination of people who have a biological or neurological brain disorder and people who have environmentally induced disorders with the causes being things like abuse or trauma. The kind of population, population terminology that you'll hear frequently is emotionally disturbed versus severely emotionally disturbed. This is something that you'll see in the laws regarding children's mental health and something you'll see in probably in the legislation that comes before you this year. The big difference is this, that a child with an emotional disturbance is basically a child who has a mental health diagnosis. It's very broad. The more severely emotionally disturbed are those children who have had inpatient placement, who have a diagnosis of psychosis or clinical depression, children who are at risk of harming themselves or others, children who have suffered from abuse or trauma, and children who are functionally impaired. The slide that you have in front of you entitled Expenditures for All Child Mental Health Services, I wanted to offer for your consideration the revenues. The top slide of the two there are the revenue sources that pay for public children's mental health services. You'll see that the largest of the pie, largest piece of the pie, is medical assistance. That is a piece of the pie that has been growing substantially over the last 10 to 15 years. If you had looked at this pie chart 15 years ago, you would have seen that the largest piece would have been county expenditures. Over time, the county expenditures have decreased, and the medical assistance has picked up a greater share of that. The county piece that you will see there is labeled social services. That includes social services fund is the county-controlled dollars, the county-controlled portion of the revenues, which includes local tax levies, but it also includes county-controlled state and federal funding, such as Title 20 and the Community Social Services Act funds. On the next pie chart down is the funding by type of service. I don't know how familiar all of you are with the different kind of services that are involved in children's mental health, but that you'll see the largest single one right there is the combination of what we call the Children's Therapeutic Services and Supports, which is our rehabilitation service, and the day treatment. This portion, the rehabilitation portion of our benefit set, has to do with children who tend to be the more severely disordered children who their treatment plan calls for them to be rehabilitated to a point back to where they would have been had their development not been disrupted by their mental illness. I was also asked to give you a little bit of an idea of what sort of children are eligible for these programs, and it's the children that we serve are a combination, like most of the public programs, of Minnesota Care and medical assistance. We also serve a number of people who are underinsured or uninsured. It's a fairly small population, but the underinsured being those whose parents have an employee health benefit, for example, but it's the benefit is lacking with regard to mental health services, and so some of those children will be served by some of our grants. I'll take any questions on that page as you wish. The next page focuses on our grant activities and our expenditures. In the Children's Mental Health Division, we divide our activities into three basic categories. As you see on your left, the access to services, the earliest possible intervention, and quality measurement and improvement. Access is, of course, broadly defined as any activity that can help a child that has a medical need for mental health services to find that service, to get into the service and be appropriately treated. The earliest possible intervention is the concept there. It's not just for young children. It's for the idea is to find any child with an emotional disturbance or a mental illness as early as possible in the process of their mental illness, and try to get to them as soon as possible, to treat them as soon as possible, so that they don't become more severe and they don't become more expensive. Quality measurement and improvement is, as you know, nationwide there's a lot of push to understand what it is that we're paying for in public programs and how well we're serving the people that are on our client list. Quality measurement and improvement is our activity in that regard, and it regards both the performance of various programs as well as a new effort to try to measure client-specific success. Is a child's treatment working? You'll see that we have, and then when you continue on down from that we have a number of we supplement some of the grants that we receive from the state appropriations with some federal funding, and that's what the supplemental federal grants line is, and then other targeted federal grants. Our administration, you'll see the full-time equivalents are in the column second to the left. We divide our staff into the area that they serve, so that when the administrative costs that you see, you'll see the administrative cost under the budget column, but the FTEs are divided above there in the three primary areas of activity. Now, as you move to the far right-hand side of the page, you'll see the the grants that we have, these are state-appropriated grants. Most of these are under a category that we call infrastructure development or capacity enhancement. These are very important activities funded by the state for the purpose of, as they say, developing the infrastructure or the capacity in all local communities statewide. What we have historically seen is that a child's ability to get appropriate mental health care has depended to a great extent on what community they live in, and we're trying to overcome that issue by building capacity statewide. So you'll see that we have one of our grants, the school-based grant that you'll probably hear more about than any of the rest of them, has to do with putting mental health services capacity right in the school where the children are. It's a non-stigmatizing place for people to receive activities. And I'd be happy to answer questions about any of the other grants that you see here.
Go ahead and continue.
The respite care grant is that's one that actually serves parents of children with mental illness. It gives them raising a child with a severe mental illness or emotional disturbance is very stressful on the family. It's very disruptive to the family. Respite care is an opportunity for parents to take a break from those kind of stresses, and what it actually does for the state of Minnesota and for the community at large is that it keeps those families together. It helps to allow children to stay in their homes and keeps the family together. The Cultural Minorities Grant is I'm sure it comes as no surprise to any of you that the number of cultural ethnic minority mental health professionals is lower than their representation in the population, and this is this grant puts some money behind allowing people who have graduated from mental health professional training education, the psychologist or a licensed clinical social worker, that sort of thing. Once they have completed their graduate level training, there is a requirement for licensure that says that they have to have a certain number of hours of supervised activity, supervised training. This grant pays for that, allowing those folks to achieve their licensure. The mental health and the child welfare and juvenile justice systems is a grant that has been it's been around for about 10 years, I think. It focuses on deep end, fairly what we call in our vernacular deep end kids, or the kids who have fairly severe issues, and it finds those children in the child welfare population and in the juvenile justice population. You may have heard the statistic over the last few years that about 66% of people in the juvenile justice system have some sort of mental illness, but they're not always easy to find.
Madam Chair.
Representative Aper.
Well, thanks, and to the presenters, I appreciate you coming. We're trying to fit a whole like car full of stuff into a suitcase here. But if you could, as you present, focus on the money and where it comes from and how much there is. There will not be enough time in our committee structures to go through the. I mean, I appreciate what you're sharing, and it's really interesting. But if you could focus on the math and where you see the fiscal pressures and where you wish you had more and where you're, those kinds of things would be, I think, helpful. Is that all right? What you did, yeah. So you can, because we have to a quarter after two, and
okay.
you know the mass. We're just it's meant to be kind of an overview with some focused math stuff. So
all right,
and people, and just for your information, there's this whole big thick little tabloid here has some narrative about these programs, and just a necessity because we have so many new people and so many veterans. We're trying to make the freshmen do some homework and yet try to be respectful of that at the same time. So anyway, so thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Cox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's good advice. I think as long as we're on this page, I'll focus you at the numbers on that page. In the middle column under the budget dollars, you'll see listed in thousands the amount of the state appropriation that goes along with each of those grants. And I'm sorry I rambled too much trying to explain what that money was used for. But it's the largest single state appropriated grant that we have is the school-based services, which is funded to the tune of $4.77 million. That one is a grant that has been pretty well used from the beginning through today. The respite care grant, currently funded at a little over $1 million, is something that took a while to get moving because, I think we're good on that one right now because it takes some time for people to start new programs in the local area. The cultural minorities, that's something, if you want a wish list, I would wish for some more on that one because we have a lot of demand out there for people who need to finish their requirements of their professional licensure. The next one, the child welfare and juvenile justice at $5.55 million. That's held steady over the last few years. I think we're good on that one. Let's see. All of the programs that, if you look at the column with the X's in it, the third column in with an X in it identifies those grants that are used as federal match dollars. So you'll see that the first more than half of our grants are used as federal match, and that's largely we're talking about the mental health block grant that comes from SAMHSA and CMHS. There any questions about federal match and how that works and what the need is?
Okay. I guess not for today. Thank you.
Good. No. It's a tough thing to explain. Let's see. So the next one down there, I think the crisis services grant, that's one that has to do with children who experience the psychiatric crisis. We've put some money out into the communities to build the capacity, mobile crisis response teams, so that they get word from a family, from the police, from anybody that there's a child in some sort of psychiatric crisis, they can respond 24 hours a day. The early childhood grant a little over $1 million. That's trying to build some capacity for serving children from birth to five, which is something that's new to the state, new to most states, and it's an emerging area. The evidence-based practices grant for $750,000 pays primarily for training. As you may know, Minnesota has advanced fairly far with regard to implementing evidence-based practices, and we have a unique way of doing that in the children's mental health area in Minnesota. The biggest obstacle to implementing that is to train the otherwise well-trained mental health professionals across the state in those new practices. Depression protocol grant for $200,000 is a brand new thing. If you've been to your primary care doctor at any time recently, you might have heard them ask you questions about the Diamond Project. It's sort of a they're trying to do screening for almost everybody that shows up in a doctor's office these days to see if there's any need for depression-related services, and this is a new thing to try to build the same capacity for children in primary care settings. So I think that's probably good enough for the overview. If you'd like, if you have any questions.
Thank you. Do any members have any questions?
Right here.
Representative Huntley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Cox, I was interested in the age. Is there, particularly for males, there's a that are coming down with schizophrenia or psychosis seems to hit when they're 18, 19, 20, 21 years old. Is there a clear line that says, well, this one's a kid and this one's an adult? How do you deal with that difference?
Mr. Cox?
Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, I'm not a clinical expert by any means, but I can tell you that there is not a clear distinction on between an adult and a child, and that transition age is something that, that we've been struggling with, and we're taking that up in a variety of ways in the last couple of years. But no, there's not a clear distinction. There's a fairly clear distinction between the children's mental health system and the adult mental health system, but even that's starting to blur as we move into transition. We have to, in those years between like 16 to 22, we need a capacity to respond either as a child system or as an adult system, just because there isn't a clear distinction.
Mr. Huntley, do you have a follow-up question?
No.
Thank you for presenting with our committee today. And we're ready for our next presenters.
Madam Chair. Our next presenter will be John Anderson on the adult public mental health system.
Hey, John Anderson, welcome to our committee. You can proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm here to present on the adult mental health system. The people we serve are typically those who have had an adult onset of their illness. Typically, our people are categorized as having a serious mental
I'm sorry, yeah. Mr. John Anderson, can you please introduce yourself to the committee for the record,
oh, sure.
Please?
My name is John Anderson. I'm the acting co-director of the Adult Mental Health Division.
Thank you. Okay, now please proceed.
Okay. Most of our people have been diagnosed as having a serious mental illness or a serious and persistent mental illness, which means that that it's been long-standing. It's typically an adult onset, usually major depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. Often our folks have a co-occurring illness. That means that they may have schizophrenia and maybe chemical dependency as well. And so they don't present with just one diagnosis. Often they have multiple diagnoses. I'll direct your attention to page 6. which gives the same kind of layout of how the system is funded. The largest portion of our system is funded through medical assistance, 43%. And then I'm just going to go around clockwise. Formerly, GMC was also a substantial portion. What you're looking at is a pie that was developed for 2009. That has been cut by two-thirds. And you're probably aware of that, the GMC problems we had last year. What that has done is it's put additional pressure on Minnesota Care. A lot of those people went to Minnesota Care. And then also to local mental health authorities, in other words, counties, social service departments, have had to pick up the slack for those uninsured individuals. GRH, Group Residential Housing, and individual funds given to clients in the form of SSI pay for room and board costs in residential. That's what that GRH slice is about. Then we have the funding going towards regional treatment centers. And then a large part of the system, and I'll be talking about that in more detail, are the community mental health grants. That's on the next page. And then we have a few specialty grants that come to us at the state. The next pie down, the RTC inpatient system, which includes the community behavioral health hospitals, is 18.5%. Oh, excuse me, that's just a no count. Is that right? And then the community mental health hospitals is right below that. So you could see that we still invest a lot of money in the state in institutional care. Community residents, those are the group homes, the intensive residential treatment facilities. We have 32 of them around the state, half of them in the metro area, half of them in greater Minnesota. And then we have other services like community support program services, which are and adult mental health rehabilitation services. And those are kind of our core services, the ones that deploy kind of as a blanket across the whole state. We have assertive community treatment teams and day treatment programs. And then the next slice up is the money that goes into case management, often provided by counties, sometimes contracted out. And then outpatient services, including crisis services. And then a small slice for administration. Turning the page to page 7, what I'll do is I'll spotlight the major grant programs that we have. We have a lot of real little ones. You can probably pick up on that just by the description here. Primarily, the biggest portion of our grant funding going out to counties happens at the regional level. We have 16 adult mental health initiatives, and they are regions that have formed together. These counties have formed together to develop a mental health system within their area. And we fund that system at $64 million a year. So that's the Adult Integrated Fund. Right above that, that's the first one. Rule 78 is the oldest funding that we have on the page here. It has dwindled. It is now at $6 million, just a little over $6 million. That used to be the formula funding that every county received for their adult mental health system. But this has dwindled. It has been chipped away. It's been transferred off for managed care. It suffered legislative reductions and so forth. And so this kind of base funding that every county receives is much thinner than it used to be. Going down to the third row, hospital alternatives to Moose Lake RTC, these are the funds that we put into the system to bolster the inpatient infrastructure that we have. This allows individuals to stay longer in an inpatient setting. It also helps the hospitals to with an operating subsidy. And so, and what that does is it takes the pressure off of the RTCs and the institutional system. We get a substantial amount of money from federal block grants. We do some demonstration projects. That's what funds our consumer survivor network. We do some work with local advisory councils with that. We do some family education and those sorts of things. We also fund a substantial amount of mental health services on the reservations with our federal block grant. And so there are a lot of little funds here. They're important, but it's probably too much minutia for what time allows, I would guess. Any questions, Madam Chair?
Representative Haas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Anderson. Of the 16 different initiatives that you briefly outlined here, what would you say are operating at capacity or where the demand for services exceeds your capability to provide services or funding?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Haas. That's a great question, and I think that in the area of crisis services, crisis response services is huge. Another area is housing, both in the form of housing subsidies and housing supports, people to support individuals as they live independently. Those are two major areas.
Representative Haas?
Madam Chair, and just one quick follow-up. If there's a lack of crisis response teams or capabilities in the community or a lack of housing, what is the most likely alternative that a person would be in?
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative Hosh, I think that both of these services directly affect both the front end or the front door of the RTC system and the back door, meaning that if you're not there to respond proactively and responsively to people in crises, you're going to have more pressure on the inpatient system and on the RTC system. And if there's no place for people to go, if they're homeless, if they're falling through the safety net, then they also end up being served in longer than they should be in our inpatient settings.
Any more follow-up questions? Representative Huntley?
Madam Chair and Mr. Anderson, it could be for the alcohol and drug abuse coming up next, but I'd be interested, and you don't have to talk to me today about it, but about the integration of people being released from jail that obviously have mental issues, and who's responsible when they get released. Is it the probation system? Is it the social service system? And how do we integrate those things? It's half the people in prison have got one of these issues.
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative, clearly, having that interface, you know, the jails are a whole different system, and it's really important that people who are in jail or incarcerated for whatever reason, that their mental health needs are addressed while they're there, but that also a thoughtful transition is planned for when they get into the community, so that they don't fall through the safety net. We're seeing that if you have a robust and adequate and responsive mental health system, it can impact or it can have a positive effect on people even being labeled, having their behavior labeled as criminal. There are a lot of people that could go either way. So we have to be very thoughtful about that problem. Thanks.
That by your answer. Representative Franzen?
Madam Chair, thank you.
Mr. Anderson,
I'm so sorry. Okay, this might be a hot topic, but recently I read in the Star Tribune, I believe, about these wet houses. Could you, I guess I've never heard of them before up until the News Tribune, and I think it's extremely sad. Could you maybe elaborate on how people are transferred into this facility? Because I do know that it is receiving state funding, correct?
Mr. Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative, could I defer that question to the next presentation? That's really in the purview of the adult, I mean, into the alcohol and drug area.
Okay. Mr. Aver, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the different presenters today, I'm way beyond today's discussion, but if you can just think about, I'm reading some of these are grants to counties and to whomever, just in terms of helping counties have flexibility and not have to, we kind of combined some and that made sense at the time. And I'm just curious which of these could be treated in the same way and where we have some accountability outcomes or something. So that's just a think about it question, and we'll have more meetings to chat about that. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming and presenting to our committee today. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Can our next presenter please come? And please state your name and identify yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Weiss, and I'm the acting director of the department's Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, which is the designated single state authority on alcohol and drug abuse. I wanted to say that we believe addiction is a preventable and treatable disease, and the interests of society are best served individuals and community with a comprehensive range of chemical health services. Just to give you a quick blur about the division, the division is responsible to develop and maintain an effective chemical health service system in Minnesota that is data-driven, encourages and supports evidence-based practices, expands the use of models, and systematically monitors outcomes. The overall goal is to reduce drug and alcohol use as well as the resulting social and economic costs through the awarding and monitoring of grant funds for prevention and treatment services, and providing technical assistance to counties, providers, tribes, and managed care organizations, and really importantly in working with the many internal and external stakeholders to gather information in developing effective policies. So I just want to give you a little blur about what the division's all about. Today we've prepared three documents. The first is the fiscal operations and activities of the division, and this is in the pie chart. And then we have a grid of the activities and then a listing of all our grants. So let's look at the pie chart. As you can see, the largest expenditure is 87% is the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. And I just want to give a quick blur of what that is. The fund pays for chemical dependency treatment for persons eligible for medical assistance, the Minnesota Family Investment Program, general assistance medical care, or meets the 100% poverty guidelines and is assessed for needing treatment services. This also includes individuals covered by third-party payment sources if their health plan pays less than 100% and meets the criteria for addictive treatment services. The Consolidated Treatment Fund incorporates federal, state, and county funds as well as third-party and recipient collections. These funds are administered by counties, tribes, and managed care organizations for eligible individuals needing addictive treatment services. Onto the pie chart. So that's the 87% for the fund. We look at the next largest expenditure, which is 9%, and this is from our federal block grant from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, which is followed by another federal grant we have, our Strategic Prevention Framework State Incentive Grant. That's at 1%. And then we have 1% of state funds, which are primarily American Indian grants. Staff costs are 2%, and the non-salary costs are less than 0.5%. If we go on to the next page, which I believe is page 9 in your packets, I'm going to go across in rows and try to give you what you want in terms of data. We have the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. We have 9 FTEs in that operations for the division. That incorporates 340 providers that have utilized that fund at $138,370,000. We've had 28,176 placements. And again, as you can see, it's a combination of state appropriations, federal, and there is an MOE on this. The MOE on this is that the treatment of this is the average spent on treatment service expense for the past 2 years. So that's that particular row. Let's go on to the next row, which is treatment support and recovery maintenance services. Data indicates that various diverse populations do not succeed in treatment at the same rate as the general population, and the prevalence of substance abuse is higher in these populations. These efforts are indicated in supporting models of treatment services that focus on the strengths as well as the needs of this population. These grants are awarded on a request for proposal. So in that particular role, you can see we have 10 FTEs, 27 grants, and the annual budget is $6,714,000. We've served a population of 2,539. These are mostly federal grants, almost entirely. The bottom G, the methamphetamine grant, is the state grant. It's a small amount compared to the larger percentage. And there is no particular MOE on that service line. Let's go to prevention. In order to reduce the prevalence of alcohol and other drug use among the state's population and age of first onset, the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division promotes evidence-based prevention strategies and model programs. Minnesota's goal is to provide effective and efficient treatment programs statewide through various grants. The grants are also awarded on a request for proposal. So in this particular role, we have 6 FTEs in that particular unit, 29 grants at $9,131,000. We've served 55,484. These are entirely federal grants, and you can see on the right some of the grants in that particular area. There is an MOE in this area, which is 20% of our federal grant. Let's move on to the women's services. We have
Mr. Weiss, we have a question for you, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Mr. Weiss, you've mentioned several MOEs, maintenance of efforts. Question I have for you is, when were these MOEs placed? In other words, when were they instituted? Were they 2010, 2009, so on and so forth? It'd be helpful. And I know you've done several of them already, but appreciate the information you have given, but if you could give the year that they were instituted.
Madam
Mr.
Chair
Weiss?
And Representative, I believe these MOEs have been part of the block grant since the reception of the block grant. I don't have the particular years, but we'll certainly get you that information that you can have.
Okay, please continue.
On to the women's services row. As I indicated, we have two FTEs, 10 grants with a spending of $4,987,000, serving 15 individuals. This is also part of our federal block grant, and there is also an MOE in this area as well, another MOE. And that MOE is equal or exceeds the expenditures from fiscal year 1994. The last category here is our American Indian Services. We have an FT of three persons in that particular unit. We have 22 grants, $2,835,000. We've served 7,117. And these are state appropriated as well as some federal money, and there is no particular MOE in that category. The last line is our operations/administration. We have a FT of four there at $637,000 that supports fiscal and operations across our division. The last page I want to share real quickly with you is a presentation or a breakdown of all our particular grants that we have. And if you need any particular more information about the grants, I'd be willing to provide that information to you. Any questions?
Do any of the members have a question? Does that complete your presentation?
Madam Chair, there is one more page on the chemical dependency area, and that would be on the next page. It doesn't have a page number, but what we wanted to do is to present you with the forecast around the consolidated fund. And if
so are you presenting the... Okay, please proceed. Representative Franzen?
Yes, hi, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. This question's for you, Bill.
Sure.
I had stated earlier about the wet houses.
Oh, sure.
Yes.
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative, the department does not fund those particular programs you're referring to. They're not licensed programs, so we do not provide that funding. My understanding is that it's a placement made by the counties. So we do not have jurisdiction for those particular wet houses.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so who's doing the next? Mrs. Jabez?
Madam Chair. We are presenting to you with the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, what the forecast is for this area. And the forecast includes the items across the top, based on the placements, based on which are annual service agreements. This gate lays out what the costs are for the CCDTF fund. On the bottom is the non-general revenue funds, which are those collections that were talked about earlier, the part that is the federal share, or the MA share, the Minnesota Care federal block grant, and then the portion paid by counties. The last column on that bottom half that says collections, those are collections that are from other sources, such as in the past they were when we would recoup costs from insurance companies that would have been liable for those costs at the facilities. And this is based on the early expansion for MA.
Okay, great. We have one more presenter?
Yes, we have one more presenter, Mike Tesner for State Operated Services.
Can you please come to the committee and present yourself and state your name for the record, please? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Tesner. I'm the CEO for State Operated Services, Minnesota Department of Human Services. I understand we're under a time constraint, so I would like to take you to page 13 and give you an overview of State Operated Services businesses that we operate and the some details around those. On the far left side, under Care Center, is the types of services that we operate. The next column over is the FTEs committed to those services. The next side over is column over is the number of sites each one operates. The next column over is the annual budget, and then the number of clients served, and then there's some additional detail. So let me start at the top with adult mental health services. The Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, which is the last large state institution we operate aside from our forensic program, which I'll get to in a minute, has 359 FTEs, serves between 400 and 500 folks a year. Average length of stay in that program is 90 days. The target population to be served are adults with serious mental illness and other coexisting disorders, things like chemical dependency, traumatic brain injury, developmental disabilities. Serves the seven metro counties area and individuals from greater Minnesota when their acuity level is too great for the services in greater Minnesota. The community behavioral health hospitals, this was an initiative that began in 2003. We opened the first set of hospitals starting in 2006. We now operate seven of these. They are 16-bed freestanding hospitals in greater Minnesota. The average length of stay in those hospitals runs about between 17 and 20 days, depending on the hospital. Each one of them, in total, they serve about 1,200 people a year. And as I said, located in Grand Minnesota. Minnesota Specialty Care, these are subacute units that basically serve persons who don't need to be in a hospital because their acuity level is not that high. So either people are diverted there prior to going to our hospital, or they could be placed out of our hospital into that subacute level of care. We're operating three of those right now, Wadena, Wilmer, and out of Brainerd. The Brainerd program is specializing in serving people with mental illness and traumatic brain injury. The Community Partnership Network is a program where we essentially contract state employees out to community, county mental health groups. They provide community-based mental health treatment statewide. And then we have a small crisis program up in Duluth. The Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services, we have two main components. One is a 16-bed inpatient hospital operated out of Wilmer. They serve on average about 11 to 12 children and adolescents at any given time. The average length of stay there, I believe, is about 35 to 40 days. This hospital specializes in serving children who cannot get comprehensive care for their complexity elsewhere in the state. So it's typically children with mental illness and other neurological disorders. The community services operated by the Child and Adolescent Mental Health side is an innovative, community-based, intensive foster care setting. It's supported by a constellation of professional staff working with the traditional foster placement to ensure that these kids with very complex disorders can return to the community in a timely fashion. The main focus of those placements is to get the family reunited with the child when that's possible. The next item down in Care Center is the Community Addiction Recovery Enterprise. This is our chemical addiction programs. You'll see that we have 203 employees, FTEs. It's actually more bodies because we rely on a number of part-time folks. We operate six individual sites with residential services. We also provide an array of outpatient CD treatment. Community Support Services is an innovative community support model. These are employees that are posted throughout the state and are able to respond to individuals when they become in crisis, working with families, other care providers, providing technical assistance and wraparound services to ensure that our best efforts within SOS, our best clinical ideas, get applied as early as possible and hopefully stabilize the person in the community or expedite their movement into a more appropriate setting when that's appropriate. The next item is dental services. We operate 5 dental clinics throughout the state. They are targeting to serve individuals with primarily developmental disabilities and a lack of access to dental care. We serve 4,500 individuals per year. As I said earlier, 24 FTEs. Our forensic services, this is operated at the other institution that we operate down in St. Peter, Minnesota Security Hospital. These is serving individuals who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous. This is an indeterminate commitment status, so this is not like other civil commitments that have an end point. The court orders people into this treatment setting, and the court discharges them from the treatment setting. Average length of stay in that program upon discharge is about 7 years. This program serves the individuals who oftentimes have criminal justice involvement and a major mental illness that's intimately woven into the criminal issue, which is how they come to us. The transition services are the folks who are attending to transition back to the community, and as you can see, there's 78 individuals there, and we serve about 162 people a year. The forensic nursing home is specifically designed to serve individuals. We currently have it licensed and available for 20 individuals. It serves individuals who either have a commitment as a mentally ill and dangerous person or a sexual psychopathic personality, sexually dangerous person, who are now served by the MSOP, or individuals on medical release from corrections. The importance to note there is these individuals have reached a stage in their life where they are so critically ill they need nursing home level of care. We still have to manage the public safety issue, but there's an overriding nursing care need that they experience. The next item is the young adult program. This program began about 4 years ago. It is inside the secure perimeter at St. Peter. It's serving primarily late teens up into the early 20s. As you heard earlier, there's a need for specialized treatment for individuals in that age range. And at St. Peter, we do that on a single unit. And then the other program operated out of the forensic services is the Treat to Competency Unit. Individuals who are engaged in the criminal justice system with some type of criminal charge for whom there is a competency question can be ordered to us for treatment to competency, which means a criminal court has a criminal case, they refer it to the civil court orders us to provide competency treatment to ensure that that individual can return to competency and go back to the criminal court for action, or that they're not restorable, in which case the criminal court would end their involvement. That program is serves well, they've got 25 beds, and the average length of stay there is, I believe, about 3 months. So how many people is that a year? 25 times 4, about 100 people a year. Next program down is the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options. This is a program that was conceived, I believe, in 1996 to serve individuals with developmental disabilities, mental illness, and who presented a risk to the public. Based upon legislation, we are in the process of redesigning how we will be treating individuals with those characteristics. Essentially, we're taking the resources now dedicated to this program and investing them in other types of services, including expanded community support services, earlier intervention, so when folks are identified, we can get to them earlier and provide some support and hopefully reduce the dangerousness, stabilize them in their placement, acute inpatient hospitalization. Majority of these folks now served in the MEDO program also have a major mental illness, and we'll be providing inpatient psychiatric services for them, and then we'll be providing an array of residential treatment and long-term residential placements for them. MSOCS is Minnesota State Operated Community Services. They provide residential, long-term residential services for folks, primarily people with developmental disabilities, but also people with mental illness, traumatic brain injury, chemical dependency. They, as you can see here, they've got about almost 1,100 employees. They operate 154 sites throughout Minnesota, 135 of those being residential and 19 being work services. And then the next items are administration. So,
we're running to the end of our time, Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, and I want to thank the department for bringing this information today. This is a really nice one handout summary of all this stuff. And if you look at your chart, in the first day we went through all the money by line item. This topic would have been a single line in the report you heard the first day. And it's this little chunk on the chart. So now you have this little bit here. And so as you go home and look it over, you'll become more astute, especially if it's your area of study. And then for especially those people who are studying areas, want to make sure you read the narrative about your particular area. And Chair Huntley and Chair Bradley and Chair Goodnow before that, how do you get all this material in a comprehensible, useful way? So,
I got a question.
You can call in the good
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Mr. Tesner, in 30 seconds, could you explain why a 16-bed facility is so important to us versus a 100-bed facility? For the new members.
The Mr. Tesner. 16, Madam Chair, Representative Huntley, the 16-bed programs came online as we were closing the large institutions in greater Minnesota. The advantage that they offer is it's a much shorter length of stay. People typically, about 80% of the folks come to us and go home. Prior to that, most people did not go home because they were in the institution long enough where they lost their home or the support services. Additionally, there's fewer civil commitments because people can voluntarily come in. The array of services in the community in greater Minnesota are woven into utilizing the CBHHs so that the length of stays can be short, they can be responsive to the needs of the individual. In addition, they tend to be located by the population centers, so they tend to be hospitalized close to where they live. All of those things are very positive. In addition, we're able to draw down federal participation because the federal government, through the medical assistance program, will pay for services in programs 16 beds and less, which they will not do in large institutional settings such as Anoka, such as St. Peter.
Representative Abler.
Well, and thanks, and I'm stealing the gavel back. Representative Hosh has a last short question.
I just have a real quick question, and this kind of builds on my question earlier when I asked about, what do we do if we have a shortage of crisis response or housing? And we just built a hospital in Woodbury, I believe, inpatient hospital, and I know our hospital beds are very overloaded, but I was wondering, are other CBHHs able to handle that type of population? Also, what is your occupancy rate at the moment?
Mr. Tesner, we're about out of time. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the licensed capacity of the 16 beds hospitals is 16. We're running right now somewhere between 10 to 12. Which keeps us available so people do not have to wait to get in. So they're coming in within a day or two of the referral. So we still have some additional capacity to fulfill.
And members, thank you. And all the staff that you saw today are willing to come and meet with you individually if you have things to know. If it makes sense to have someone come back and digest some of the math here, and if it's productive for a group to do that, I'm open to that. Make sure you save this into your save folder for now. This is something to look at. The Minnesota Psychological Association will give you a handout if you want to read. And hearing and feeling any more business, we're adjourned. Thank you.